I must admit, I've never sung that before, and I didn't realise quite how suitable it would be for what we're going to consider now. I just looked at the title and thought, there is a higher throne, that fits, but it fitted far better than I'd realised. Well, have you ever wondered why people fight against God? Why Jesus provokes such a reaction? Think about nations, for example. You could take Albania, then back before 1990 when it was a communist country, and the government were determined to stamp God out of the country. So, there was a student at the National University in the library looking through, they had those old-fashioned card index systems, I'm sure universities don't bother with them anymore. He was flicking through looking for a book and he came across a card and it said, the Bible. Well, that rang a bell with him. He didn't have a clue what the Bible was, but he'd heard of it. He thought, I'd like to have a look at that book. I can't think why I've heard of it, but I'd like to have a look. So he went off to the librarian and passed her the card, and she gave him a funny look. He said, well, I'd like to take that out. He said, I don't think you can take that out. Well, there's the card. I'd like to take it out, please. Well, I'll have to go and see my manager. So off she went and came back, said, sorry, you can't take that book out. Oh, well, not to worry. I don't need to take it out of the building. Can I just look at it and read it here? I don't think you can do that. Off she goes again, comes back. No, sorry, you can't read that book. Well, that mystified him, but off he went, forgot about it. A few weeks later, he was in the library again, and he thought he would have a look again and have another try at reading the Bible. So he looked through the card index, looked through. There's no card there for the Bible anymore. They've taken it out. Why were they so concerned to stop him reading the Bible? By the way, I suppose I'd better tell you the finish of the story, which is that actually, years later, he was given a Bible by someone, rather secretly. And then, years later after that, as you know, communism collapsed. And in Albania now, well, before you had communism and no Christians, now you've got Christians and no communism, at least, not in power. But if there's no God, if the Bible is just a set of myths that we've got here, why were they so afraid of it? If it's just like Aesop's fables, why didn't they treat it like that? But if God is, and this book is true, how stupid of them to fight him. How mad to ignore and to try to ban what he says. Why fight God? But it's not just nations, is it? It's individuals. I used to go to a church where we would have preaching in the marketplace once a fortnight. And sometimes children would stop and listen, and their parents would tug them along because they wanted to take a leaflet, and they wanted to listen, and their parents would get annoyed with them and whiz them off. But why? If Jesus is just like the tooth fairy, yeah, a nice story but untrue, or like Francis of Assisi, good man, a load of myths have risen up around him, well, why so anti him? Why get so het up? But if Jesus did rise from the dead, if he is Lord of all, how mad to be anti him? How cruel to keep their children ignorant of him? Why fight God? Or another example, I've got a DVD of Richard Dawkins involved in a debate with a Christian. And he gets a bit hot under the collar, but he basically manages to debate reasonably. Not that what he says is true, but, you know, he manages to think things through and keep his calm, basically, until right at the end, the Christian mentions the return of Christ, and then Richard Dawkins explodes. Why, though? If this is some quaintly ridiculous belief that a crucified man of 2,000 years ago will return and end the world, well, such a silly idea, will soon die out and be forgotten. But if it is true, and that belief will last for thousands of years, as it has, and he will return and destroy those who oppose him, how mad, why fight against God? Well, that's the question of Psalm 2. It would help, please, if you have that open in front of you. Page 543 in the Church Bibles. Page 543, Psalm 2. Where the psalmist asks in verse 1, why do the nations conspire and the people plot in vain? Why get together and plan and rage and plot? Well, it's all in vain. It's all useless. the world. Society, rulers, individuals, they're against God, don't want him. And the psalmist asks, why? Why, when it's in vain, it's hopeless to fight him? So I want us to consider now this irrational rage that people have against God, the rightful ruler. So first of all, let's look at the reason for raging. The reason for raging. And it's given in by what these people say in verse 3. Verse 3, they say, let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. We won't be tied down by what God says. It's my life, I'll do my own thing. I couldn't put up with all those do's and don'ts. That's why people fight. Because there's some recognition in all that the Creator can command and that his subjects should serve him. But we don't want to. We've all inherited Adam and Eve's character. And what did Adam and Eve say? We'll be our own God, actually. We won't do what you say. We'll be God around here. And we've all inherited Adam and Eve's attitude. What was that? God's a spoilsport. Look at these rules he's put so that our enjoyment is spoiled. He's a spoilsport. His rules restrict us. And so these people rage against what they think of as God's chains and his fetters, making them prisoners. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. Now, do you see the relevance of that to you? When I say about Albania and about Richard Dawkins, maybe you say, well, that's so distant from you, isn't it? So distant. That's not me. I'm a churchgoer. I believe. Maybe you say, well, I believe the things in this book. I'm not fighting God. Do you have the attitude behind fighting God? It's my life. I'll do my own thing. Is that the attitude? Or maybe you wouldn't say that, but in this area or that area, you just don't think about it, but get on with. It's my life. I'll do my own thing. Blank out thoughts of God. Does this ring a bell with you? That God says, do all things for my glory, and you know that. And then maybe your conscience says about something you're doing, how's this for God's glory? How is it for God's glory? Instead of arguing back, you just blank that out and get on and do it anyway. Maybe very unthought through. Maybe almost subconscious, but it's the attitude here of verse 3, the attitude behind fighting God. Is that you? At our church in Hayes, we have a youth club every Friday. And last year, we were going through the Ten Commandments with these teenagers. Now, they don't think they're fighting God. They listen in very well. They're on the whole, polite, good children. And some of them would say they're Christians. They don't seem to have much understanding at all of what that means. And I was speaking on the fourth commandment and tried to show them God's way is best. Physical intimacy is God's gift to be used his way, that is in marriage. And they said they basically agree with that. Oh yeah, we can see that's sensible, yeah, that's right. And then, when you question further, they say, but when it comes to it, actually, we'll do what we want. They're like verse 3, aren't they? They're saying, let's break off God's chains. We won't have him rule over us. However well they sit there and listen and look good. We just won't have him rule over us when it comes to the crunch and there's a clash between what we want and what he says. Now, I don't know this church at all. And I don't know you at all, do I? But I would guess that that's some of you, isn't it? Isn't it? I would presume that some of you who've heard about turning to Jesus but not done it. Is that you? You've heard about turning to Jesus but just not done it. You've heard about leaving sins but you've clung to them. You've heard from the Bible, maybe even year after year, but it doesn't seem to have any impact in your life. Why is that? I would guess it's not because you're deaf. It doesn't, if the moment is anything to go by, look like it's because you're asleep normally in the sermon. Hope not. If anyone is, please nudge them. I doubt it's because the message is incomprehensible, is it? I doubt it's even because you believe the Bible's a pack of lies. Why is it then? Isn't the answer here in Psalm 2, verse 3? You don't want God to rule over you. You don't want him in complete control. Okay, I'll give him a bit of control, but complete control? No, I want to do things my way. Is that right? Is that you? Would you admit that? The problem is here, in a sinful heart that wants to go your own way. That's the reason for the raging of the world. That's the reason why all of us, Christians, we've got to admit this, haven't we? All of us have areas where we're not submitting to God. It's true, isn't it? And we only have to examine ourselves a bit and we'll find some of those areas where we're not submitting to God. That's the reason why, I would guess, that some of you are still fighting God. So there's the reason. Secondly, let's look at the response of God. It's given in verses 4 and 5. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath. He laughs. Now, this isn't the laughing of a soft teacher. You know the sort, don't you, that there's the naughty child but can't find helping the child adorable and just can't restrain laughing at the child and then letting him off as he does something wrong because, you know, oh, he's so adorable, isn't he? And he is quite amusing what he said. That's not what's going on here. It's a laugh of derision. It's a laugh at the stupidity of those who fight him. So when people on TV blaspheme, when the Bible is mocked, when nations fight against God and make rules against his church, does God get nervous and scratch his head? Oh, I never expected this. What am I to do? Everything's going wrong. Oh, that country is just getting out of my control. He laughs. He laughs at their puny stupidity. He laughs because neither they nor anything they can do will derail his plans. He laughs because they're like an ant which is there on the ground waving its little legs at the elephant's foot coming down on it. And however much that ant waves its legs, that elephant's foot is going to come down and crush it. And that's what they're like to God. And so, for example, in Acts chapter 4, verse 25, we read about this verse being put into practice. We read that this was true when Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles raged and fought against God and crucified his anointed one. And God laughed because they were doing just what he'd already decided should happen, so that the anointed one should rule, and so that millions should be rescued from rebellion and made his willing servants. And then go on a few decades, and the Roman Empire raged and threw Christians to the lions and turned Christians into Roman candles and crucified thousands of them. And God, oh yes, he looked in sorrow on his people suffering, but God laughed. Because he gave his people strength to endure, and he took them to glory with himself, and he made his church grow phenomenally. God laughed because he was in control, so that one of those church leaders, Tertullian, as he was up in court in front of those Roman rulers, could say to them, "Kill us, torture us, grind us to dust. The more you mow us down, the more we arise." And then go on to the present today. What's a nation that rages against God today? Well, let's take Iran. Surely that's one of the most fiercely anti-Christian regimes in the world. And its parliament at the moment is considering having the death penalty for leaving Islam. And God laughs because the underground church in Iran is growing and flourishing. And Iranians around the world are being converted. There are churches with stacks of Iranians in the UK. And the government of Iran can do nothing about it because God is in control. Or go back exactly 60 years, actually, China, 1949. And the missionaries were thrown out, and there were less than 2 million Christians in China. And there they were. They were getting thrown into prison. They were getting tortured. They were getting killed. Disaster. Looks like the church is going to get eliminated. It's going to die. As the nation raged and the rulers took their stand against the Lord and against his anointed one. And God laughed. Look at those puny rulers there. And God laughed because all their raging couldn't stop his plan to grow his church. To grow his church so massively that now, how many Christians are there in China? Well, who knows? The best educated guesses seem to be 80 million. That's just in China, and wherever you find Chinese around the world, you find people being saved. And so the government, having failed, they set up atheist areas. Right, we'll really stamp out religion in these areas. And God laughed and made those the areas of the country where the church has flourished most. And so the government raged further and said, OK, we'll have one city that's a model for killing religion, and I'll probably completely mispronounce its name, Wenzhou City. And God laughed, because now it's the most Christian city in China. Even the official statistics, which underestimate, say 300,000 Christians there. That's not exactly Christianity dead, is it? Why do the nations rage? And the people plot in vain. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Why does he laugh? How is it that God can, in a sense, we could picture him, sit back and laugh? Why? The answer's in verse 6. That's the key to the psalm. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. So, thirdly, the ruler of the world. We've seen, first of all, the raging of the rebels. We've seen, secondly, the response of God. Thirdly, the ruler of the world. Who is this king in verse 6? Well, we're told, aren't we, in verse 6, he's the king you'll find in Zion. Where's Zion? Well, Zion is Jerusalem. Who's the king in Zion? Well, at the time this psalm was written, the king was David. He was God's king because he was to represent God, and he was to implement God's rule, and he was to govern God's people, Israel. But that was only a shadow, just a faint shadow of the king yet to come. The anointed one, we read that in verse 2, don't we? And I've kept using that phrase, there it is, the anointed one. The Hebrew for anointed one is Messiah. The Greek is the Christ. The one, David there, the king of Zion, a shadow of that future anointed one, the one who would over his cross have written, Jesus of Nazareth, the king of the Jews. But more than just the king of the Jews, the one who in the book of Revelation would be described as the king of kings and the Lord of lords, the ruler of the whole world. So let's spend some time then considering who Jesus is. Who is this king? First of all, he's the king God has installed. There it is in verse 6. God says, I have installed my king. God has put Jesus as king. Not Muhammad, not Buddha, not Guru Nanak, not Bill Gates, not whatever forces are in control or seem to be out of control over in the Middle East at the moment, not Mother Nature, not the financial markets and the economic powers. No. Jesus is in control. If your life feels out of control at the moment, take comfort in that. Not all those other things. Jesus is in control. God made him king. So people can rage and they can resist and they can disbelieve and they can follow others, whoever those others might be. It makes no difference. He's still king. He rules over the millions. In fact, we can say billions, who don't believe. So think of it this way. Do you realise this? Sometimes we say, don't we, or we can be misled into saying when someone becomes a Christian, they've made Jesus king of their life. It's not true, is it? Because Jesus is already king over everyone's life. When you become a Christian, you simply recognise and submit to him as king. Already the rightful king, and stop rebelling against him. Who's Jesus? He's the king that God has installed. But what else do we read? Verse 7. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. He's the son of God. Now, when this was written, David was the king of Israel, and David was called a son of God. Why is that? To show God's close fatherly love for him. Jesus was called the son God loves at his baptism. He was one that God was especially close to and had an especial fatherly love to. But you know, don't you, it's much more than that. It means much more just than just God loves him. Maybe at Christmas time you read Mary was told he will be called the one you're going to carry in your womb will be called the Son of the Most High. Because he miraculously comes from God. But it means much more than that also. He's called repeatedly in the Bible the only begotten Son. What's that mean? It means he wasn't created, he's not a creature like David was, like you and I are. But he comes from the Father. So just as any father and son in this room are equally human, so also the Father and the Son are both equally God. He's the Son of God. What else do we learn about Jesus from this psalm? Let's move on to verse 8. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. He's the owner of the nations. He must be the owner, mustn't he? Because God says here, I'll make them your inheritance. I've got money in the bank, which it was my grandparents. And they said in their will that it should go to me, so it's my inheritance. So that's that. I own it. That's that. People can't take it away because I've inherited it. It was theirs. They've given it to me. God, who made the world, gives the nations to Jesus as his inheritance. So the Chinese government may say, we won't have Jesus here. The Saudi Arabian government may say, no worship of Jesus allowed here. But it makes no difference, does it? Because they belong to Jesus. He has them as his inheritance. And so all over the world, we can see Jesus being proclaimed and believed and obeyed. And all that will keep on going. And keep growing until all the nations are covered with his kingdom. And then what? Then what? Then he'll return and remake it all, the whole world, for himself. But Jesus not only owns all the world, all the nations, he also rules them absolutely. Let's have a look at verse 9. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Now, we have a queen, don't we? And the queen has a sceptre, and the sceptre is a symbol of government, isn't it? You know that, so we understand that verse 9 is talking about government when it talks about a sceptre. She has this sceptre. But it's only a symbol, isn't it, her sceptre? It's not actually used to strike down enemies physically, it's just a symbol. And the queen, she's our head of state, isn't she? But it's only symbolic, really, isn't it? She doesn't actually wield power. She can't make and change laws, although her signature has to go on them. If she refused to give her signature, there'd be a crisis, because she doesn't actually wield the power. Not so with Jesus. What does he have? Verse 9. A scepter of iron, and it's brought down hard on his enemies. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. What are his enemies like? Well, we've just read it, like pottery. Why are they described as being like pottery? Well, I thought we'd do a little experiment to find out why. I hope you don't mind. Maybe you're not used to visual aids. But I have some pottery here. Vase. It's got nothing on the bottom to indicate that it's an expensive make, so we can do a little experiment with it, can't we? This is a bit of pottery, I suppose. And I have, not an iron scepter, sorry, but an iron bar. Yes, so it says, you will dash them to pieces like pottery. So if we're to take this piece of pottery, and if we are to hit it with this iron bar, what's going to happen? We can do a little experiment, couldn't we? But I'm not going to, because we don't need to, do we? Yeah? Because You know full well what's going to happen. There's no need to do the experiment because there is no doubt of the outcome when you hit pottery with an iron scepter, is there? And there's no doubt of the outcome when people oppose Jesus. There's no doubt of the outcome when people oppose Jesus. They will be smashed and destroyed. There's no doubt of the outcome when you oppose Jesus. You will be smashed and destroyed. We didn't need to do the experiment. You know full well what the outcome will be. Don't do the experiment and oppose Jesus because there is no doubt of what the outcome will be. Well, no, not really. Can't be, can it? Surely not. You know, this is religion we're talking about. And religion is all relative, isn't it? And you take your choice and you pick and choose. And kind of, if you want to follow Jesus, follow him. And if you don't follow him. And that's up to you, isn't it? You know, what we're talking about here. That's how people think, isn't it? And that's what people say, isn't it? Maybe that's what some of you think. What nonsense. Isn't it nonsense? You go to the doctor and the doctor says, you're ill, take this medicine. You say, oh, well, that's true for you, but what's true for me is I'm going to take this poison. That's all fine. It's nonsense, isn't it? Or you go to the petrol station, oh, the makers say that I should put unleaded petrol in my car. That's true for them, but it's all relative, isn't it? I'll put diesel in my car today. It's nonsense, isn't it? God, who made this world with its absolutes, do this, don't do that. God, who made this physical world like that, he put Jesus on the throne and he says, obey him or get destroyed. Well, let's have a look fourthly at responding to the ruler. This is final section, verses 10 to 12. Responding to the ruler. Now, we all know about rebels, don't we? We see on our news rebels in Afghanistan and rebels in Iraq. And in the Bible times, there were rebels. And if a rebel saw he was going to lose, there's no hope for him, he's going to lose, he's going to get destroyed, what should that rebel do? What would you do if you're a rebel and you're going to get beaten? Well, what the rebel had to do is to acknowledge the king. Yes, I acknowledge you are the rightful king. And the rebel would have to plead mercy. That isn't go and say, look, you should accept me because this and this. But he's just got to plead. Just plead that that king would be merciful to him. And you'd also have to, wouldn't you, promise that now you will live as a loyal subject to that king. And back in those days, that would have been symbolised by kissing the hand or the hem of the king's robe. And we have that in verse 12. Verse 12, kiss the son, lest he be angry, and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. You must do those three things I've just said. Acknowledge the king. Jesus is king, and acknowledge him. You must plead for his mercy. That means not going to him and saying, look at this and this in my life and accept me, but pleading, admitting you're guilty and pleading that there's nothing you can plead apart from his mercy. That means promising to live as a loyal subject. We've got that in verse 11. Serve the Lord with fear. Let me say that again because it's so important that we've all made sure we've done those three things. That means acknowledging Jesus is king. It means pleading for his mercy. It means promising to live as his loyal subject. And verse 10 tells us, be wise, take this warning. Be wise and take the warning. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. You've heard about Jesus destroying those who fight him, those who won't submit, those who say, I'll have my independence. So be wise. Be warned. Verse 12 tells us, you could be destroyed midway. His wrath, it can flare up in a moment. And you don't know when you'll be summoned before this king. You don't, do you? You could be knocked down by a car on the way home. You don't know, do you? And what then? Will his wrath be flaring against you? just down the road from where we live, a big heap of flowers has appeared on the grass verge. And it's pretty predictable what's happened, hasn't it? So last night I stopped to have a look, and there are cards pinned to the tree, and there's someone called Terry being killed in a car crash. All these tributes to him. Amongst them, an interesting poem, Why Wait? And it's all about how we wait until someone's died, and then all the things that are too late. Made me think, why wait? We do wait, don't we? People, millions of people across the earth wait until it's too late and they're dead and they haven't come and acknowledge Jesus as King. And it's too late. There's a man called Steve who for the last year and a half has been coming to our church in Hayes. Such a nice man. Ah, great man to have a conversation with. Very appreciative of the church and loves coming along. And yet, last time I spoke to him, he said, I don't want to get too involved. I'm a bit worried about taking religion too seriously. You don't want to get too much taken up with these things, do you? No, I just like to come along and to listen in. And it's nice, isn't it, to be here. But I don't take it too seriously. Yesterday, Steve died of a heart attack. Where is he now? Because he hadn't, as far as we know, acknowledged Jesus as King and pleaded his mercy. Be wise. Verse 10 says, take the warning, be wise, submit. But be wise also because of verse 12. Let's have a look at the very last line of the psalm. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Be wise because there's blessing, there's happiness, there's rejoicing in coming to him. It's not just a matter of avoiding the danger, it's a matter of receiving the happiness. Because like any good king, Jesus not only destroys his enemies, he cares for his people. Verse 12, blessed are all who take refuge in him. What do you think of when you hear that word refuge? I think of going up a mountain and there's a blizzard coming and you know that somewhere up ahead there's a refuge, there's a shelter, and you'd better get to it before the blizzard comes and you want to get into the warmth and the safety and the shelter. Jesus says, you're in danger of being destroyed by me, but there's a shelter, there's protection, me. Come to me and I'll shelter you. And what a shelter he is. Romans 8 tells us, come to him and neither death nor life, neither the present nor the future, neither family breakup or job loss and financial difficulty, neither failing health nor your own failings can separate you from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord, our King. There's blessing. There's blessing, isn't it? There's happiness. There's reason to rejoice. I think of a story I heard from Gerard Crispin. I'm told that he comes from down this area. I didn't know that until speaking to someone at the prayer meeting. Gerard Crispin, for those who don't know, goes around visiting prisons. And he spoke about a man called Steve. I don't know if that's his real name. Steve had been in prison for 15 years. Wrongfully. Now, Gerard Crispin worked for the Crown Prosecution Service, and I don't think he's easily taken in, but he was convinced this man was wrongfully imprisoned. And he went through all the appeals he could, but got nowhere. He stuck there in prison. And while he's in prison, his family weren't remaining faithful to him, so it seems like in every area his life is falling apart. And yet one day, Steve said to Gerard, coming to prison was the best thing. Being put in prison was the best thing that could happen to me. What are you talking about? Your life has fallen apart in every area as far as anyone can see. I accept this, he said. Being put in prison was the best thing that could happen to me because in prison I heard about Jesus and now I belong to him. That's real Christianity, isn't it? It sees who Jesus is and it says he's worth 15 years in prison. Easily. Have you got that? Have you got that real Christianity? Have you got him? No longer as the king out to destroy you, but as the king who cares for you. He invites you to come to him. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him.